Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock album. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the all-important missing link in the evolution of hard rock.
When you don't have a vocabulary musically that will allow you to make an elaborate statement, you make your statements direct, concise, and to the point. And I think the first Montrose album musically does that, which is just raw, you know, energy, but with absolute intention, enthusiasm, and everything that goes along with making a statement for the world to hear with what resources you have to use.
And I actually, you know, basically knocked on the door and said, "Hey, look for a singer." He said, "Yeah." He said, "You got any songs?" I said, "Yeah." And I played him those songs, and he shook hands and said, "You know a good drummer?" I said, "Yeah." and we got Denny, and he had Bill Church. We had a band that had a record out in about 4 months. We were on tour.
We'll also feature the new Ronnie Montrose album, 10x10, featuring Tommy Shaw, Joe Bonamassa, Mark Farner, and Sammy Hagar.
Hey, this is the Red Rocker, Sammy Hagar, in the studio with Red Beard.
Hi, this is Ronnie Montrose, in the studio for Montrose.
To put today's interviews into perspective, we need to understand the distinction between influential rock albums and popular sellers. You see, some of the most significant albums in rock history have been modest sellers. We're talking The Velvet Underground, Elvis Costello's My Aim Is True, The Grateful Dead's American Beauty, and Working Man's Dead. Even David Bowie's quintessential Ziggy Stardust was more written and talked about than actually sold. And believe it or not, until Blood on the Tracks, the great Bob Dylan's many classic albums raised much more awareness than rang up sales. But the impact that all of those albums had on other performers was enormous. Now, you can trace the beginnings of hard rock back to the Kinks, You Really Got Me in All Day and All of the Night, Steppenwolf, Led Zeppelin I, Deep Purple's In Rock, and the debut from Black Sabbath. They all pointed the way in 1970 towards hard rock, but the next high watermark occurs all the way in 1978 with Van Halen's First. The sound, the technique, and the production are vastly different. How did hard rock make that leap? Well, the linchpin is the 1973 release bearing the surname of a California born-and-bred guitarist named Ronnie Montrose. He'd gigged with Van Morrison, played that seminal riff on the Edgar Winter Group's number one Frankenstein, then returned to San Francisco, where a few years earlier he'd seen Jimi Hendrix live at Winterland. Here's the late Ronnie Montrose with me in the studio.
I didn't see Hendrix when I first picked up the guitar. I probably didn't see him until I was... I didn't see Hendrix play until I was 20. And the way that it affected me was that there was something going on here that was quite a bit out of my grasp as far as the amount of intensity and the amount of conviction that was being exercised on an instrument, on a person, and on an audience, and on a lifestyle. It was something that was completely out of my... I just didn't get the concept for quite some time before I realized what exactly was going on, you know, personally with a personal relationship with an instrument and as a form of expression.
Rock the Nation from the 1973 album Montrose. In hindsight, Ronnie Montrose noted how their youthful exuberance made up for any lack of musical chops back then.
Yeah, and I think one of the basic things that really helped pushed the Montrose album, which I think pushes a lot of new albums today, as a matter of fact, is that when you have a limited knowledge, which I certainly did at the time, of chord structure and of musical changes, you have a limited vocabulary, you want to make the words that you do know, you want to make them count. And so when you don't have a vocabulary musically that will allow you to make an elaborate statement, you make your statements direct, concise, and to the point. And I think the first Montrose album musically does that, which is just raw, you know, energy, but with absolute intention, enthusiasm, and everything that goes along with making a statement for the world to hear with what resources you have to use.
That's One Bad Two-Wheeler from the debut Montrose album in 1973. Bad Motor Scooter features original Montrose singer Sammy Hagar.
You know, it was as silly and as lucky of being in the right place in the right time or taking a weird shot, which should give anyone confidence out there that's sitting around with nothing going for them in their life. It's just as bizarre as how I got in Van Halen. It's the same thing. It just popped up. I was doing nothing. I mean, I had a band, and we were like a club hardcore funk band. You know, Tower of Power, James Brown, Joe Tex, Sam and Dave, R&B stuff. And I was singing and playing guitar with a keyboard player and a bass player and a drummer. And in a club, and I had written Bad Motor Scooter and Make It Last, One Thing on My Mind, I Don't Want It. I had those four songs, and they're the first songs I ever wrote in my life, and the band hated them because they were rock and roll. I would say, no, I want to be rock and roll. I want to be more like the Stones and more like David Bowie at that time, who had just come out, and Alice Cooper. And these guys are going, oh, man, we hate that crap. And I said, okay. And I took them to Winterland. I said, let's go. I want to show you guys what kind of band I want to have. And Edgar Wintergroup was playing. Ronnie Montrose is in the band. And Edgar Wintergroup was kind of a rock and roll funk band because he had come from White Trash, which these guys dug White Trash. So I was thinking, well, I get him through the back door, you know, introduce him to Edgar. So I didn't know Edgar, but I'm saying to that kind of music. So we go to Winterland. We're in the audience, and Ronnie Montrose blew my mind. He was like totally Mr. High Energy, Mr. Metal guitar rock and roll hero to me. And I was going, this guy, that's what I want to be. This guy's great. And the next day I was bragging about how great he was, and some guy goes, I know Ronnie, man. He lives, you know, just, you know, a couple miles from here. And he just quit. That was his last gig with Edgar Winter. He's looking for a singer. He wants to start a band. I went, I'm there, dude, Beavis and Butthead style. And I I got the guy to take me to his house, and I actually, you know, basically knocked on the door and said, hey, looking for a singer? He said, yeah. He said, you got any songs? I said, yeah. And I played him those songs, and he shook hands, said, you know a good drummer? I said, yeah. And I took him to show him Denny Carmassi, who was, his band was trying to get me in their band called Thunderstick. And we got Denny, and he had Bill Church. We had a band that had a record out in about 4 months. We were on tour. Just from nothing to everything, and really was amazing.
After graduating from the Edgar Winter Group, Ronnie Montrose returned to San Francisco, where he discovered a young, untested club singer in the Bay Area.
I went to see him, and he was playing at a nightclub in Fisherman's Wharf, which is, the nightclub is no longer there. It was called the Wharf Rat. And he was playing cover tunes, you know, top 40 type of a thing. Went down, and I liked the way Sammy looked. To be honest, I wasn't completely knocked out with his voice, and it took... I will say now that Sammy's voice has improved greatly from the time of the first Montrose album. And it was a difficult job getting a vocal performance out of Sammy at the time because of his inexperience in the studio. And that's certainly something that he shouldn't have to defend or feel embarrassed about. That's just the way it is. A young singer coming out from a nightclub band. And it took a lot of work, and it took a lot of grooming, but I saw the raw talent there, like other people had seen in me, and decided to make a go of it.
From the 1973 hard rock classic Montrose, that's Space Station Number 5. Up next, Ronnie Montrose and Sammy Hagar reveal who helped them record the sound that would influence hard rock to this day. I'm Redbeard, asking you to please help Houston and the Texas Gulf Coast residents devastated by Hurricane Harvey. Donate now to the Salvation Army. Toll-free 1-800-SAL-ARMY. That's 1-800-SAL-ARMY, and it's toll-free. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with the debut Montrose album. When Ronnie Montrose hired the young, unproven singer Sammy Hagar, Ronnie got much more than he first realized.
I had no idea that Sammy was a writer, and I was looking for more of a singer and a personality on stage with me. And the fact that he could write was a bonus. And one thing that I think was, and I don't know because I haven't collaborated with Sammy in years and years, but one thing that was great about Sammy is that he was prolific as a writer and would have books of lyrics and not necessarily write songs, but just write stream of consciousness lyrics, which I was able then to help assemble and arrange, and that was a real good plus. As far as the production on the first Montrose album, Ted Templeman was very excited to do that record because he had been in a group called Harper's Bazaar who had done Feeling Groovy, you know, and had done Doobie Brothers albums. And neither one of those had the hard edge that the Montrose thing had. It's certainly obvious that Denny Carmassi has been extremely influenced by John Bonham, and well, he should have been. And, I mean, Rock Candy at the time came about because Denny had been listening to When the Levee Breaks. I mean, it's the same exact groove. And fortunately, it wasn't in my mind because I listened to Zeppelin and I listened to Stairway to Heaven and I listened to the first Zeppelin album. And I didn't know that song that well. I honest to God didn't know it. And if I'd have known it, I'd have probably said something stupid like, Denny, don't play that groove because it's too close to Bonham. But since I didn't, I decided to just jam on it, and that's how Rock Candy came about. And we would not have had Rock Candy if I hadn't just randomly that day had my little cassette player going in the studio. And the next day I said, what was that groove and that riff that I played that was there, and we'd had it on tape? And if we hadn't had it, we'd have lost it.
One of the Montrose songs that changed hard rock forever, that's Sammy Hagar singing Rock Candy from the Montrose debut. Bill Church on bass and drummer Denny Carmassi rounded out the four pieces' huge sound. Remarking on producer Ted Templeman's involvement on that first Montrose album, again, here's Sammy Hagar.
Well, say Ronnie Montrose, again, him and Bill Church had played with Van Morrison, and Ted Templeman produced them, so they knew Ted. And Ronnie called Ted up and said, hey, I got a band, you want to see him? And Ted said, yeah, sure. So he flew up to see us. We just rented a little rehearsal studio, and Ted, we had Rock Candy written by then. We had Space Station Number 5, and we blasted a set for him. His jaw dropped, said, let's go in the studio like now. We didn't even do a demo. We didn't have to wait. We didn't even try anything like that. We just went straight to the big time. We played one club, our first show, just to see if, you know, what kind of, how these tunes would go over live. We played a small club in San Francisco, and opening for somebody else probably, and that was it. After that, we went straight to a concert. We never even built a club following or a local following or nothing. By the time we came back to San Francisco, the album was doing pretty good, and we were like a headliner. It was great.
Here's the late Ronnie Montrose with me in the studio.
I'm sure Denny at one point mentioned to Ted that he liked the Zeppelin drum sound, like every drummer worth his salt playing rock has to tell a producer. And we went over to, I remember we recorded the album at Amigo Studios, but we went over to Sunset Sound in L.A., which had a big sort of a garage room to record Rock Candy and I believe another one, I don't remember which one, but to get that big sound, the big open sound. As far as what you call state-of-the-art recording techniques and state-of-the-art sort of hard rock sound, it was just basically a guitar going through an amp with a microphone on it, no effects, I mean just none to speak of, and no treatment, nothing, just that's where the raw energy comes out, which was what a lot of the new speed metal bands are doing nowadays, which I've produced a couple of speed metal albums, and I'm understanding that there's not that much distance between the way they want to sound and the way that the Montrose band sounded. There's a lot more gymnastic approach to the instruments, but as far as the actual sonic quality, I think it's very similar. I saw Guns N' Roses the other day on a video. I thought how similar they are to as far as sonic sound and as far as the way they're coming across as to Montrose and Aerosmith in the 70s. It has that same kind of feel to me. I think the only thing close to Montrose at the time was Aerosmith. The only American band close to Montrose was Aerosmith at the time. It was basically playing sort of hardcore rock and roll. And I have a real problem with trying to figure out why or what happened with the record company. But I feel that, looking back on it, I feel that the record company, that Warner Brothers, and maybe any other record company, I'm not saying it just them, but at that time they didn't quite know what to do with a band like Montrose. And we were sort of like the token house rock and roll band. You know, I was never made aware by the record company at all that there was something great going on. Except for Ted Templeman, who told me at one point that we were selling a lot of records, which didn't register to me at all. It took the Montrose album quite a few years, probably 10 years to go platinum. I mean, it's platinum now, but it's been just one of those steady building, constantly, you know, moving up kind of records, which I feel is better because I buy a record if I don't buy a lot of pop records and I don't buy a lot of modern rock records because they seem to date real fast. But it seems like people will buy a record for one or two songs, play it, listen to it for a while, and then it goes in their collection and doesn't come out for a year. As far as what was happening with Montrose, and I think another thing that like sort of at the time blew my mind is that I was like, you know, I'm out of San Francisco, and we'd recorded an album, and it was a big thrill to hear our record on the radio, and we were going across the country doing some touring, and I remember we were in Detroit somewhere, and I was in a supermarket, or a, you know, convenience store, and there were some people over in the next aisle, and I heard them all say, "Where are you going tonight?" "Oh man, I'm going to the Montrose concert," and I'm standing in the next aisle going, God, maybe there's something going on here I don't know about. And that was really a revelation for me that, you know, that the group had become sort of like popular on a nationwide basis.
Another huge sounding pile driver from Montrose's 1973 debut is Make It Last. That album and the only follow-up, Paper Money, have both been remastered and are available now. Still to come, veteran bass player Ricky Phillips joins us in the studio for Ronnie Montrose's swan song album 10x10, featuring a different superstar guitarist and singer on every song. Joining Ronnie are Sammy Hagar, Edgar Winter, Tommy Shaw, and Joe Bonamassa, plus more. Ronnie Montrose 10x10 is available Friday in stores and online, including Amazon. I'm Redbeard. That's next in the studio. Welcome back in the studio. I'm Redbeard. In 2003, Ronnie Montrose had an idea for an album, and the concept was straightforward enough. Write and record 10 songs and have 10 different superstar vocalists sing one of each. Ronnie Montrose had listed current Styx, former Babies bass player Ricky Phillips, and drummer Eric Singer for the core of the 10x10 project. The instrumental tracks and Ronnie's guitar parts were all dispatched easily enough, but the best-laid plans of mice and men and Montrose often go awry. The recording project, Sprint, extended into a relay. Ronnie, Ricky, and Eric each finished his leg of the relay, but sadly, just not all at the same time. Ronnie Montrose's cancer diagnosis and battle and subsequent death in 2012 turned the 10x10 trip into a 15-year odyssey for Ricky Phillips. Long before you, Ricky Phillips, developed into a first call bass player, how did you discover Ronnie Montrose's music?
Oh, man. Well, I discovered Ronnie first when he was with the Edgar Winter Group, and I was a huge, huge fan. When Ronnie, of course, went to Montrose, now here's another great blueprint to steal from. Everything Ronnie did was on the money for me as a player. And I've talked to so many musicians who say that first Montrose record was considered, it was mandatory reading for all of us. I mean, we all had to consume that record and learn it, probably more so than just the average Joe. I think every musician found that something very useful to glean how to play rock and roll. And it's just amazing to me that the band didn't go on longer than they did.
Well, they were. Let's remind each other. They were very, very young. and Sam will tell you that, you know, he'd never been in a pro band before. I mean, and so I think Ronnie was a little further down in the road in his career, and Sam, he told me one time, he goes, you know, the guy didn't like singers.
yeah. Well, you know, I think Ronnie was probably the most unique, wonderful, crazy, lovely guy that I've ever known in so many regards. And in when it comes to singers, here we are. We just finished a record with 10 of them. And that was always the joke, because when he called me up one day and said, I've got this idea, we'd cut these tracks. He said to me, I've got an idea. We're going to call the project 10 by 10. It'll be our 10 songs with 10 singers. And I thought, well, that's a great idea, but we can't even find one singer that you'll get along with. So how are we going to get 10?
And that is so funny that you bring that up, because I was writing that out in the margin. Like, I wonder if anybody noticed the irony in this.
I think to the people close to Ronnie, it speaks volumes, but it works. I mean, he made the choice. He picked almost all of the singers himself. Unfortunately, left us before all of them, but I already knew who he wanted. I knew who he liked all the way down to when he wasn't able to do his guitar solo. So I knew who the guitar players were that he didn't really like, and I knew the guys that he was crazy about, that he loved what they did. And so those are the guys I went to.
How and when did you first meet Ronnie Montrose, and then how did your relationship develop?
Ronnie and I knew of each other through my buddy Skip Gillette, who was the original drummer in Gamma, and I had just joined the Babies, and my very first tour was flying on private airliners around the country with Alice Cooper. We were opening up for Alice, and Ronnie wanted a message sent to me immediately saying, kid, this isn't the way it normally is. You're ruined for life. And when he heard that I was landing at private runways around the country on my very first tour ever, he had to give me a little bit of a stab of reality. And then years later, a great buddy of mine, Chuck Wright, really great bass player here in Los Angeles, had been working with Ronnie. And talk about full circle, he got a gig with Alice Cooper and said, I know you're a big Ronnie fan. I've told him about you, and he'd like to get together. And if you want the gig, it's pretty much yours. So Eric Singer and I, who had been friends and had done a little bit of work, studio work together, became the rhythm section for Ronnie. And, it was just one of those things where the three of us instantaneously just had this thing. And it's when you find others that have that complement your style and make you sound better than you feel you are, it's something you don't want to let go of. And I felt that we all collectively were so secure immediately. We didn't really know each other that well in the beginning, but it was such a good fit that it was almost like we'd known each other for years.
Colorblind comes from the new Ronnie Montrose album 10x10 and features a musical reunion of Ronnie and Sammy Hagar. With the fascinating backstory, here again is producer, bass player Ricky Phillips.
What I liked, I think, the most about Ronnie is he was real gut level, and even right down to recording without click tracks, wanting to record on tape, even though knowing it would be married to digital later on, he wanted to get that sound, you know? The big thing that I've been kind of running into with 10x10 is this is Ronnie's concept. This was his concept. I had been working, writing lyrics and to the material. And when he called me up, he said, I've got an idea and I think you're going to like it. There's part of it you won't like. And I said, well, what's the part I won't like? He said, well, you know, all those melodies I said I've been loving that you're coming up with. The only way my idea is going to work is if the singers I'm talking about are able to be themselves and write their own. And then when he explained, I want 10 singers. And I said, well, what do you mean that 10 singers, we can't get along, you know, with one? He said, I'm talking about Sammy. I'm talking about Edgar. He, you know,
Greg Raleigh, Mark Farner, all these great friends of his that are wonderful singers in their own right, he wanted to turn it into something that was a little bit more than what a band generally delivers, and just spread it out with every color that you can think of, all of these singers being very different, but also very, very good. And I immediately took to the idea and thought it was a great idea. So it's, and now here we are talking about it all these years later.
Even though you're a veteran pro, have you ever done a project quite like 10x10?
No. No, not at all. All the way down to Ronnie wanting to go into the studio very unprepared. He wanted to, as he put it, do it the old-fashioned way and go in where not everything was completely nailed down, where there were loose ends so that you could figure that out while the music was being played and captured for the first time. He wouldn't let us overdub any mistakes. Ronnie always said that if a track speeds up or slows down, that's just music breathing, man. That's not a mistake.
Really? Boy, is that, I mean, that's so antithetical to, you know, the click track world we're in, right?
Well, yeah. And if, for me, being a bass player, I had to nail that kick drum for every producer I'd ever worked with. And that was, I felt, had become such a priority that it all probably, it, I'm not going to say hindered, but I think it would probably prevent me from being exploratory. And that's what Ronnie wanted. He didn't want to be thinking about time. He wanted you to go in there and walk the beast. You already know how to play. Now let's just go in there, shut your brain off and play. And that's what he got out of us. And he was really, really particular. There are three songs, Redbeard, that we never played before we recorded them. I don't even know how to explain that. There's three songs on the record that we knew the parts, we'd rehearsed the parts, and once we figured out what those parts were, Ronnie said, okay, has everybody got the arrangement? And we'd look, Eric and I would look at each other and say, yeah, or we might be say, now, well, how are we going to go from this to this? And he goes, just watch me, I'll signal. And the red light went on for record, and that's the only time those three songs were ever played.
Oh, come on. That is amazing. I don't think I've ever heard anybody tell me anything quite like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, some of the other songs were songs that Ronnie had ideas that he was developing that he kind of had more honed down. But the way he liked to work was for things to really kind of come together while it's being recorded so that it has that energy to it of what he felt was the way rock and roll should be recorded.
Every documentary filmmaker, Ricky, will tell you that what they thought they were making continued to morph and shapeshift until completion. How did the thing you started come to evolve into what you now present to us as Ronnie Montrose 10x10?
Wow, what a great question. Well, I wrestled with a number of things. The people, which I alluded to before, the people that I would now invite into Ronnie land, you know, something that was his vision. And I made sure Ronnie Montrose is loud and proud on every single track. That's one of the things I wanted to stress, even with the record company, about how this is marketed. This is not a tribute record. This is Ronnie Montrose's last recordings. And everyone else on it is a guest on, you know, in his playground. So Sammy Hagar wrote this brilliant song, Colorblind, and it's an instant grat track you can get right now, iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud. When I talked to Sammy, I said, now I'm opening the door for another guitarist to come in, and he mentioned a couple guys. So I said, what about, and I had Steve Lukather in mind, and Sam just immediately said, wow, yeah, okay, Steve Lukather, that's a great call. So I got a hold of Luke. He was in Singapore, and he texted me back and said, oh, my gosh, I'm be honored. I'm glad you guys even thought of me. It was just, you know, it began to unfold like that. Just happy story after happy story. Now, as I said, there are certain people I went for that I wasn't sure that their management was really getting the message to them. I wasn't able to actually speak to people in certain cases, got a little bit frustrated on a couple, but in the end, that was such a small percentage. And in the end, I really feel that the right guys are on this record. Mark Farner, who was a dear friend of Ronnie's, came on board and did an amazing vocal and took over. And you know, Mark is just such a unique talent. I see why Ronnie loved him so much. I didn't really know Mark until this project. Edgar, I called up Edgar and I said, listen, your song is amazing. Your sax playing is amazing. Your keyboard playing is amazing. Your voice is out of this world. My natural inclination is to call Rick Derringer to play the solo on this song, because now you've got three Edgar Winter Group members all on the same track. And Edgar said, Ricky, I think that's a fabulous idea. I'd love to have Rick on this track. So I called up Rick, and it took a while to kind of get our schedules together, but he was in Florida, and in Rick's case, I had to set up a studio in Florida for him to go in and record to do his part. We discussed it a little bit, basically in text messages, which is a weird way to communicate, but that's what we were doing. And it starts off with Ronnie and Edgar harmonizing on sax and Ronnie's guitar, and morphs into Rick Derringer joining in and playing harmony guitar through the body of the middle of the song. And I'm just getting goosebumps. Think it's so good.
That's great. That's Love Is an Art. Yeah, that's one of my high points too. Hey, Ricky, on a superstar target list, usually one or two key musicians are deemed as linchpins, you know, critical to getting other stars to say yes. Now, besides Ronnie as the centerpiece, of course, who else did you identify as key gets for 10 by 10?
I think Sammy, of course. And I'm such an Edgar Winter fan. I think that Edgar is as well. But there are certain people like Joe Bonamassa who's just blown up. I've watched Joe. You know, there's a great story, and I hope Joe doesn't mind me telling this. And I picked up Joe at his hotel room, and we were driving to the studio. I said, you know what? I know Ronnie really loved your playing, and he spoke about you, but what's the connection? And Joe said that one day the phone rang. This is when we used to have phone machines, and people picked up the phone and couldn't see the number before they, right? And he said, I got this phone call, and I answered the phone, and a voice said, is this Joe? And he goes, yes, it is. And he goes, this is Ronnie Montrose. Hey, man, I just heard your new record, and kid, we need more like you. Keep doing it. And they struck up a relationship, and as he puts it, Ronnie was always very kind to him before people really knew who he was, and it always stuck with him. So he was there for me, and really for Ronnie, right away when I called him, and I was very grateful for that. And there, you're right. There are certain guys that when Ronnie was able to get Greg Raleigh to come in. And most people know Greg, but for those who don't, Greg started, he sings Black Magic Woman with Santana. He was the singer in Santana and all their early great big hits. And then, of course, went on to start Journey with Neil Sean. And when I was in the Babies, we toured with Journey quite a bit. And I remember sitting by the pool with Greg and his now wife, and they have grown children. And he was telling me he was leaving Journey, he was quitting Journey. And I said, are you out of your mind? You know, he had everything that I, at a young age, I wanted. The biggest band in the United States with huge hit songs, touring the world, and the center of attention at the party every night. And he was leaving that to raise a family and live a normal life, which I now highly respect. But yeah, I mean, it was so awesome when I found out that Ronnie had gotten a hold of Greg, and Greg does an incredible job on the track that he sings. He kind of, I get sort of a Roy Orbison almost vibe out of his approach, which is very unique and cool.
Ooh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. It's funny, Ricky, you're hitting all the ones, all of my high points on the album.
Oh, cool.
Love Is an Art, Colorblind with Sammy, The Kingdoms Come Undone with you, Ricky, and Joe Bonamassa. And now I can't wait to get all the way through the album to get to the last track. I'm Not Lying.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
with Greg Raleigh and also your band Made in Sticks, Lawrence Gowan.
Yeah, how's that piano playing, man?
I mean, I love this song.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's really funny. It's a track that I tried to, when I sequenced the record, it just kept coming up. I remember saying to Tommy Shaw in the dressing room, he said, "What's up?" And I told him, "I'm trying to sequence this record, man, and there's so much good stuff." It's like, "Where do you place it?" And I realized I can't sequence it the way we used to. In other words, you'd stack the front side with singles because there's no record company that's going to be working a single. This isn't the kind of record it is. This isn't the day of the flavor of the month, and this is just good music. So he said, "What's your dilemma?" And I said, "I keep having to put I'm Not Lying last because," and then Tommy finished my sentence. He said, "Because what else can follow that song?"
Oh, good answer.
And then I was kind of almost relieved when he said that, because I feel that's the case.
It's an incredibly cool arrangement. It's a timeless song. It's got guitar that evokes, you know, Dick Dale surf and Wes Montgomery jazz.
I love it. I called it one middle guitar. I played this, it's kind of like a 12 string behind Ronnie's beautiful soaring melody in the middle instrumental section. And that's when I contacted my buddy Tom Gimbel, who's a sax player in Foreigner. I said, "Can I get you to come in and I'm going to write you a sax part. It's going to complement Ronnie's guitar." And then behind that, I played this 12 string that I affected in all kinds of, I was calling it the Quentin Tarantino guitar part, because it does kind of evoke this movie theme background with
no
that saxophone.
Question. No question.
And it was really fun to build that song. And I, that's one I just wish Ronnie was here to listen to, because I think he would have a big smile on his face.
He does.
He does. Thank you for saying it.
No, you definitely. I got just one point, one personal thing, just me to you. You showed incredible restraint as a producer and arranger. Incredible restraint, and I might say courage, by letting that song, I'm Not Lying, it stops dead twice and decays, and it is just so counterintuitive for a producer not to want to fill that space. And that would have been a tragedy, because it's so cool and brave to let that happen twice in the song.
I thank you, Redbeard, for saying that. But I think that Ronnie would have kicked my ass if I would have done anything else. That is, to me, I agree with you. The word anticipation isn't even enough. I've never heard it like that on a record before, and that was Ronnie's idea, and I was not going to mess with it.
It's brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant. Ricky, how did you know when to stop? How did you know when you were done?
This is probably the easiest record to know when to stop that I've ever done. I kind of had little, you know how everything, as you were alluding to before, even in other, mediums, you sometimes can get lost. And in this case, I think it's because it's a little game I played with myself. I'd had to answer with Ronnie after every decision, even after it had been recorded, because you can certainly erase something if it isn't working. Very little erasing went on. And once I got to a certain point where the song felt right and felt good, and I felt that all of the hit marks were there that Ronnie would approve of, I would listen to it maybe 20 more times, but I would listen to it not wanting to cover up anything. And I really didn't want this to be, it started in the 80s when everything got reverbed out and bombastic drums and all this. I wanted very little compression, even all the way down to, I talked to my mastering guy. I said, his name is Dave Collins. I said, "I don't want this louder than one thing's louder than everything else. I want this I don't want it to be smashed and overcompressed. I want this to be a 70s sounding record as much as possible, even though we've gone from 2-inch tape to digital. I want to keep the integrity of air in this record. And he did a great job.
Well said. Ricky, Little Feat had an album called The Last Record Album, but it wasn't. Is 10 by 10 the last Ronnie Montrose album?
Unfortunately, I think it is. We don't have a lot of stuff. Ronnie and I have a few things that are out there, but not enough to warrant. I think that this is an amazing way to go out, and I want everyone to know that all the work I did, I'm proud of, but Ronnie's the one who came up with the concept. Ronnie, there's one song that the music started with me, and I was flattered because I pitched him a lot of stuff, and he basically came up with all this music. Still Singing with the Band is the song I was talking about that musically I just had this kind of lot of space like I know Ronnie liked. And then he and I had the riff a little bit different that opens up and is kind of the repeating riff that starts each verse. He and I morphed that into what it is now. And I should add that what he did with it made it much better than it was when I had written it originally. But these ideas are Ronnie's ideas. These guitars that are loud and proud are Ronnie. And when you're listening to it thinking, oh, who is this playing the solo? It's the solo. All those guitars, as big as they are, that's Ronnie Montrose. And he's the one that gets the credit here.
Well, listen, this has been such serendipity that we had the chance to do this, because now and only now do I understand why Ronnie Montrose's widow Lisa was so adamant in her email to me that 10 by 10 is not a tribute album. I certainly now see the critical distinction.
right. Yep. Yeah, that's one of the things that you would naturally... I discussed this with actually Lisa, and I've discussed it with my very first meeting with Rhino, who, man, thank God for Rhino. They totally got this from the very beginning, and we're so lucky, I think, at this point, even looking back to that first meeting, we're so lucky to be here, because this could have been treated improperly in so many ways. And this is Ronnie's last recordings. It's not a tribute record. Everybody's being very careful to market it that way. And let it be known that what these guitars you're hearing, that's Ronnie. And I mixed it that way, loud and proud. As I said before, Ronnie was first and foremost on every track, and then we built around it.
Understood. And I really appreciate you clarifying and giving all the backstory. It's really interesting. And once again, I can't wait to see, with your video of returning to the studio. And I can hear the emotion in your voice, and that's a good thing. I mean, that's a good thing. And I appreciate you taking the
time. No, I do. I talk when I I discuss it, and I think of excuse me, little things. It does choke me up sometimes. And I spent the day with Eric Singer doing this filming, and we get the same way. It's like all of a sudden we have to change subject real quick. quick change the subject. But it's really important to us. He was a dear friend.
Well, great, and thank you so much for your dedication. And hopefully, one of these days when I bump into you backstage, we'll have time. I've got several Ronnie Montrose stories to tell you. That record, that first Montrose album, changed my life. I mean, it changed my life, it did. It changed my life. It changed my career. There's no question about it. None.
Well, let's make that happen. I'd love for that to happen.
I'm Not Lying closes out the posthumous Ronnie Montrose album 10x10 with wonderful vocals by Greg Raleigh of Santana and Journey, plus Lawrence Gowan of Styx. The rest of this final Ronnie Montrose album features Sammy Hagar, Edgar Winter, Steve Lukather, Tommy Shaw, Joe Bonamassa, Phil Collin of Def Leppard, Rick Derringer, Brad Whitford of Aerosmith, Glenn Hughes, Mark Farner, and Eric Singer. Ronnie Montrose 10x10 is available Friday everywhere, including Amazon.
I've had just about everyone that I've come in contact with at one point or another tell me that they listened to the first Montrose album and that they were very impressed and very inspired. And I think it's great. I mean, I really like it. What I like is, what really touches me is the fans who have stayed with me through all of the changes I've gone through, all of the ups and downs and all of the turbulent times of me trying to establish some new ground and some new territory and just trying to experiment. Because I've said that there are two types of fans in my book. There are fans that are drawn towards a certain style of music, and for better or worse, that's a fickle fan, because that fan is going to be with you as long as you are playing the music they want to hear. There's nothing wrong with it, but that fan is going to leave you as soon as you depart from the style that they want to hear. And then there are fans that I call true fans or deep fans, who really like, are attracted to what you have to say, and in whatever means you choose to express yourself on a personal level, and they're going to stick with you. When a guy comes up and at a show and asks me if I'm going to play like some obscure song from the Territory album or from Open Fire or from the Mean album or whatever, the albums that I've done that certainly weren't mainstream, that gets to me, and I really appreciate that, because that means people are really sticking in there and dealing with me as an artist on other levels other than just like trying to satisfy the masses. And while it's great, I mean, there are groups that certainly the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and the Stones that have got that strong foothold and are able to take fans, a large amount of fans, through their changes. It's a lot tougher when you're not, a mega platinum artist to even have anybody be aware that you've even got an album out. So that means a lot to me. It really does.
I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Sammy Hagar, Ricky Phillips, and the late, great Ronnie Montrose. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.